Today is Friday, May 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a rise in a rare inflammatory syndrome in children that's linked to COVID-19.
Inflammation of the blood vessel, inflammation of the heart, but it's quite serious.
President Donald Trump pulls out of another global treaty.
Ending such agreements without anything to replace them could result in destabilizing activities such as a dangerous new arms race leading to possible miscalculations.
Also ahead, an effort to end the so-called wet markets where the pandemic is thought to have originated. It's all on today's International Edition. The number of countries that have reported cases of a rare inflammatory syndrome linked to COVID-19 and impacting children has nearly doubled in the past week. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, in his daily briefing on Thursday, said the state has taken a lead in tracking the so-called multi-system inflammatory syndrome in children.
New York State Department of Health was the first to really investigate this. The more they investigated, the more cases they found. Last Thursday, there were 7 countries that also investigated and found cases. There were 17 states that found cases, okay? This was last Thursday. Today, there are 13 countries and 25 states. This is one of those situations where the more they look, I believe the more they're going to find. So when we're talking about schools, again, the facts have changed from the quote-unquote experts because there are no experts on this COVID virus.
Cuomo said it raises concerns about when and how to allow schools to reopen. U.S. President Donald Trump toured a Ford Motor Company plant now making ventilators outside of Detroit, Michigan. And the big question going in was whether he would wear a mask. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The president's refused to wear one in public, telling aides it makes him look weak. As reporters and cameras watched Ford executives guide the president, he was the only one not wearing a mask, but says he had earlier.
Here's my mask right here.
Pulling a White House branded one out of his pocket.
I had one on before. I wore one in this back area.
He says he didn't want to give reporters the pleasure of seeing it. Ford requires everyone in its factories to wear masks. It says Executive Chairman Bill Ford encouraged the president to wear one when he arrived, and the president did during a private viewing of some cars before taking it off. Sagar Magani, Washington.
African Americans have been hit hard by the pandemic's economic fallout. The unemployment rate for Black Americans is nearly 17% compared to 14.5% for white Americans. Tapping into federal financial help hasn't been easy either for these Americans who have fewer economic resources than others. Michelle Quinn reports.
Terrence Kahn hasn't worked at his Oakland barbershop since mid-March when California's shelter-in-place order went into effect. He hasn't applied for federal help as his income dried up.
Actually, I called the bank, but they said that they were not accepting any more applications. You know what I'm saying? So you don't really know exactly which way to go being a small business because it's not much information out there available to you.
Kahn is fortunate. He has a little savings and his wife works at a grocery store. But the fact that Kahn hasn't tapped into any federal help is common among African-Americans, say observers. Black people in the U.S. have been among the hardest hit economically in the crisis. Unemployment is higher for Black Americans than white ones. Many Black business owners do not have relationships with banks or the financial cushion needed to weather hard times, they say.
Thank God I had a little savings. You know, other than that, my savings is dwindling, but, you know, who can I really complain to?
Derek Johnson, owner of the Home of Chicken and Waffles restaurant in Oakland, was able to get some federal assistance, but he worries about his employees.
A large number of individuals in the communities in which I employ from, like I said, don't have internet, don't have access to internet. So how do they apply for unemployment? How do they even know about any of these, you know, programs that are going on?
Beyond financial help, tapping into networks that can help Black business owners get back into business is also a struggle, says Carolyn Johnson, executive director of the East Oakland Black Cultural Zone.
Again, it goes back to network. A lot of businesses, if you have the right relationships and you can call someone and say, can you make sure when you get a truck of gloves or whatever, you hook me up, that helps. But again, if we're not networked and in those circles and people don't think, by giving your friend who's a business owner that box, who are you forgetting?
Restaurant owner Johnson says he helped his employees apply for unemployment, and he and other Black business owners call each other and give advice.
It's the time to not really panic, relax, take a deep breath, and call all of your creditors, call all of your, whoever you have to pay bills with, and let them know, look, I can't do it.
For Ken, the barber, it is touch and go.
You know, thank God that I am able to sustain for a little while, but, you know, I just don't know how long, but we'll see how it goes. You know, I just keep praying. I keep, you know, just try to keep a positive attitude.
Michelle Quinn, VOA News, Oakland, California.
Prime Minister Hassan Diab says Lebanon, now suffering from an acute financial crunch and facing a COVID-19 outbreak, is also at risk of starvation. He warns the multiple crises could spark a new migration to Europe, and he's asking the United States and Europe for financial help. Dale Gavlak reports from Amman.
Prime Minister Hassan Diab warns that Lebanon faces a major food crisis sparked by money problems and COVID-19. The illness caused by the coronavirus. He says the crisis could see people unable to buy bread, an essential staple. Inflation, poverty, and unemployment have soared in recent months, with prices of goods doubling in many cases. The financial crisis is on a scale never seen before. Analyst Michael Young says there are only two ways ahead for Lebanon. One is to carry out overdue reforms that will permit the International Monetary Fund to provide $10 billion in the first phase of a bailout plan. Young says he believes it is the only available key to unlocking wider foreign aid from the World Bank and the West. The other choice, he told the national newspaper, is to follow the path leading to bankruptcy, state collapse, chaos, possibly famine, and mass emigration. Professor Habib Malik of the Lebanese American University says reforms are badly needed, telling VOA that Lebanon faces difficult, stark choices that won't be easy to enact.
Lebanon is suffering from multiple very profound challenges. We know that the IMF is not a charitable organization. They will come with all kinds of very austere conditions. This will translate into the suffering of those who did not cause the problem, but who really have received the short end of the stick. And the same political class that did all of this is just going to hang around. It's the same criminal political class that got us here.
Janine Jalk, who writes for the Lebanese daily L'Orient Le Jour, says Lebanon cannot object much to whatever conditions the IMF will set. That's because economists agree that unless key sectors of the economy are restructured and thoroughly reformed, and the independence of the judiciary restored, no further bargain would be allowed in the current circumstances. She says the IMF won't be willing to compromise on needed reforms in Lebanon's case if its bailout plan is to be effective. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Diab announced that Lebanon's central bank will start providing dollars for food imports as part of necessary measures to defend the pound, which has lost more than half of its value and sent prices soaring. Diab says basic food items will be imported and prices monitored, so Lebanese will soon see a decline in costs. Diab's comments come amid a raft of power outages that electricity officials are blaming on increased consumption due to a heat wave. On Thursday, police scuffled with protesters who made their way into the Ministry of Energy to protest the power cuts. In past rallies, protesters have blamed the political establishment for rampant corruption and poor public services, while demanding a complete overhaul of Lebanon's sectarian-based politics. Last week, top central bank official Mazen Hamdan was detained for questioning about the manipulation of the dollar exchange rate with the pound, charges the bank has denied. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
In Ghana, the COVID-19 pandemic has spurred people to adopt innovations in healthcare, from apps that help diagnose coronavirus symptoms to drones transporting blood samples. As confirmed infections continue to rise in Ghana, reaching over 6,000 cases and more than 30 deaths, health tech experts want to ensure people have access to needed medicine and doctors. Stacy Knott reports from Accra.
For the last few years, healthcare tech company Redbird has been working to ease the burden on hospitals in Ghana with technology that can help pharmacies diagnose and monitor chronic and tropical diseases, saving user information on an app. Now the company has added a function that helps people diagnose whether they have COVID-19. Users can input symptoms into an app and keep track of their movements to determine if they have been in contact with a confirmed case. Co-founder of Redbird, Andrew Kwal, says organisations can use the app to prevent the coronavirus from spreading in the workplace.
Even post-COVID, in quote, like organisations are going to have to come back to work, right? And you're going to have to find a safe way of coming back to work, right? Not every organisation can work remotely. So this is something that is moving ahead and helping organizations to sort of like plan this and be able to say, okay, I know my people, okay, we are gonna be back in 2 weeks. I want to know everyone, like who's been in touch with a COVID patient. Like, okay, you don't need to come, like let's not risk it for the other people.
With a shortage of healthcare facilities across Ghana and to encourage social distancing, Ghana's doctors have looked to technology to consult patients remotely. Dr. Emmeline Opuku has started consulting patients via a mobile application, which she sees as a way to provide healthcare while ensuring people stay home as much as possible.
When the pandemic started, I noticed that most of the people were scared to come to the clinics and the hospitals because they thought that they were going to get the infection from there. So then Talamus reached out to me and they were like, how about we take this opportunity to use telemedicine as a form to reach our patients.
Talamus is a company set up by a Ghanaian doctor who lives in the US. Country manager for Talamus Ghana, Joshua Owusu-Ansa, says the app Opuku is using is part of his organisation's mobile health platform where all aspects of a patient's healthcare can be accessed digitally. He says COVID-19 has underscored the need to utilise technology for healthcare.
I think it's going to be an eye-opener to show Ghanaians and Africans especially that there's less stressful ways of doing things, right? Because to get a lot of things done in Ghana and Africa is really, really hard because a lot of our systems are just kept manual. So this is one of the eye-openers that's going to show us that we need to do some things using technology. We need to leverage technology to do some things.
Perhaps the most famous example of healthcare tech in Ghana is the Silicon Valley company Zipline's use of drones to transport medicine and blood samples. Since the pandemic started, drones have been carrying samples from suspected COVID-19 patients to laboratories in big cities to speed up diagnosis and help authorities keep track of any outbreaks. Stacey Knott for VOA News, Accra.
The COVID-19 pandemic is said to have originated from infected bats at a wild animal market in Wuhan, China. Wildlife experts say this is something they've been warning about for years. Now, an effort is underway to end the so-called wet markets and the capture and trade of wild animals, including bats and endangered pangolins, among others, in hopes of preventing another, potentially even more deadly virus that could impact the globe. Joining us to talk more about this effort is Peter Knights, CEO of the San Francisco-based organization Wild Aid. Peter, thank you very much for being with us. Tell us about the End the Trade campaign and what the focus is on.
The focus of the campaign is to look at high-risk activities in high-risk species. So we know, for example, that mixing live wild animals together with different species in the same place, cages on top of each other that might cross-contaminate, is a really bad idea. And so all live wildlife markets need to be banned around the world. We also know that some species are particularly high-risk. Bats, for example, can latently carry viruses that don't impact the bat but are very contagious and can be passed to another species and ultimately to humans. And we saw that with SARS, for example. It went from bats to civet cats in wildlife markets to human beings. There's other animals like primates that are also very, very risky because they're so close to human beings in their nature that it's very easy for a disease from a primate to jump to a human. So we know with HIV, for example, it jumped from monkeys, chimpanzees, and then during the butchering in the bushmeat process, drum to humans. And so what we want to look at is the high-risk activities and make sure they're outlawed around the world.
Are there specific animals, like you just mentioned, bats and primates, that are of particular concern that are being traded in large numbers?
Bats are very dangerous. They carry a lot of different viruses because they operate at a very high temperature in their metabolism. They're able to coexist with these viruses without it killing them. And then obviously if they're kept in cages above other animals, they're defecating, they're passing on disease. Pangolins, we know, carry a lot of different viruses, including coronavirus, in different places. So even if this doesn't ultimately end up to have come, this case doesn't ultimately end up to have come from pangolin, there's a very good chance in the future that it could be caught through pangolin. And in fact, one of the dishes that's consumed, they actually eat fresh pangolin blood that hasn't even been cooked. And so obviously, if you're not cooking things, that also increases the risks. And so you've got to look at the different species. You've got to, I think, also look at not just disease to human beings, but disease to domesticated animals, which they may then reach human beings later. So there's disease risk from then as well of wild animals. But there's also high-risk behavior. So if someone goes out in the bush and hunts an animal, kills it, and they eat it, and that's it, that's relatively low risk compared to if someone goes into the bush, traps something, keeps it alive for weeks and weeks, where it's malnutrition, it's dehydrated, its immune system lowers, and then a latent disease can then come out in that animal, and it can shed that disease. And if you then mix it with other species, some of which may be predators, for example, the stress levels get even higher. And so the risks of transmission get more and more as you do this. And then if you ship that animal live into an urban center and you keep it in a live market where it's exposed not to just one hunter, but to hundreds of people potentially in very stressful conditions, the disease risk goes up. And also if you're in an urban center, the chances of it then spreading from that urban center internationally by an airplane gets higher and higher. So if we're looking at pandemics, these are the high-risk activities that we need to eliminate.
What is the End the Trade program doing to make that happen?
So the End the Trade has got two real purposes. One is to talk to governments around the world to try and get them to address this situation. And for example, in China, they already have come up with a list of species they think it's going to be okay in the future. Semi-domesticated animals like quail and pheasants and deer that people have consumed for a long time, generally are slaughtered on site, not brought live. They're looking at that being able to go forward in the future, but probably not being able to be sold in live animal market. And that's the kind of action we're looking for governments, particularly in Southeast Asia, places like Indonesia, Vietnam, have wildlife markets and they have wildlife restaurants. And then in Africa, particularly Western Central Africa. And in Africa, of course, there's much more likelihood of consumption of primates, monkeys or apes, which is a higher risk as well. So we're looking for governments to lessen the list of what is acceptable, not just in terms of being endangered species, but in terms of health risk. Then we're looking for stricter laws in terms of stricter penalties. In some cases, it's a slap on the wrist for trafficking bushmeat. And obviously, this is something which risks the entire global economy. It needs to be treated as a much more serious crime. And then we need better enforcement. And then ultimately, the other point of End the Trade is going to be public awareness and education. Because, you know, the real key to this, laws are great, but we need the public to understand how risky it is to consume these animals and to change their behavior.
Working to mobilize a global response to get people
Absolutely.
To really pay attention to this.
This isn't a problem in one country. And as we've seen, it very quickly infects the entire planet. So we need an international response. And we don't think it's very helpful at this time to be trying to point blame. We need to get all the information, all the cooperation together. This cat is out of the bag. We now need to ensure this doesn't happen again in the future. With frankly something that could be more virulent than COVID and more deadly. It's out there. We've known about these things for a long time. We've known about the transmission mechanisms of wildlife trafficking and wildlife trade. We just need to do something much more serious about stopping it. We'll never have a bigger wake-up call about the dangers of overtaxing nature and exploiting nature in irresponsible ways. Some of this risk is heightened by things like deforestation and climate change. What we're seeing here is potentially animals that haven't really been exposed to human populations before. And then suddenly someone deforests an area, puts in logging roads, that reservoir of animals, which may be carrying diseases we haven't encountered before, is then accessible to the rest of the world. A lot of these problems are interconnected, and it really is about treating nature with a little bit more respect and being a little bit more cautious than we have been in the past. Because if we don't, you know, we have these tremendous repercussions, and we just got to take these threats, I think, a lot more seriously and a lot more imminently. People feared it would have a cost in human lives. I don't think anybody predicted the massive economic cost involved in this. It literally has affected every person on the planet. And yet it doesn't take that much investment in better enforcement and in public awareness to greatly reduce the risks of this happening again. I mean, we've always argued it's not an either-or thing. You know, if the environment is essentially our natural wealth, and if we mess with it, degrade it, it will hit us in the pocketbook ultimately in some way. But it couldn't be clearer right now, these massive, massive costs.
Peter Knight, CEO of WildAid, thanks for being with us. Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. The United Nations rejected an accusation by the United States Thursday that the world body was using the coronavirus pandemic as an opportunity to promote access to abortion through its humanitarian response to the deadly global outbreak. The UN is seeking some $6.7 billion for its coronavirus response plan and has so far received $1 billion, of which $172.9 million was given by the United States. A medical charity working in Yemen says a coronavirus catastrophe is unfolding. The main coronavirus treatment center in southern Yemen has recorded at least 68 deaths in just over 2 weeks, more than double the toll announced by Yemeni authorities so far. A spokesperson for the Yemeni government's coronavirus committee in Aden has not yet responded to the report. And the most powerful cyclone to strike eastern India and Bangladesh in over a decade has killed at least 82 people as rescue teams scoured devastated coastal villages, which are being hampered by torn down power lines and flooding over large tracts of land. Mass evacuations organized by authorities before Cyclone Amphan made landfall undoubtedly saved countless lives, but officials say the full extent of the casualties and damage to the property won't be known until communications are restored. Stay with VOA for all the latest U.S. and world news. President Donald Trump says the U.S. is withdrawing from the Open Skies Surveillance Treaty. Trump said Thursday that Russian violations make it untenable for the U.S. to stay in a treaty that permits 30-plus nations to conduct observation flights over each other's territory. But he hinted it's possible the U.S. will reconsider the decision to withdraw.
Our relationship with Russia has improved greatly, especially since the Russian hoax has been proven totally false.
Trump's announcement comes as the U.S. begins new nuclear arms control talks with the Kremlin aimed at replacing an expiring weapons treaty. But a U.N. spokesman is expressing concern that withdrawing from the Open Skies Treaty could make the world less safe.
Reiterate our concern regarding the erosion of the U.S.-Russia arms control regime. I think we can't stress enough that this arms control regime has provided security benefits for the entire international community by constraining strategic arms competition. Ending such agreements without anything to replace them could result in destabilizing activities such as a dangerous new arms race leading to possible miscalculations.
You're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour.
Whoa.
Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews.
Ooh.
Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world.
Ah.
Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Eid al-Fitr, the most festive Muslim holiday, is marked with celebrations, friends and family reunions, and a lot of feasting. This year, the coronavirus is threatening to dampen the spirit. VOA's Aisha Tanzim reports on how Muslims in various parts of the world are planning to celebrate Eid this year.
Shops are finally open in Pakistan after a nearly two-month lockdown because of the coronavirus. It's days before Eid and customers are rushing to make up for lost time. The crowds in many bazaars are ignoring warnings and guidelines to protect against coronavirus. Rosina Abbasi is roaming around in an overcrowded bazaar without a face mask.
I don't think it's such a big deal. I want people to continue their lives and routines as usual. Whatever is fated to happen will happen.
Unlike Pakistan, many countries such as Egypt are still closed. Eid al-Fitr marks the biggest shopping season in most Muslim countries. But this year, many businesses will feel the pain of lost income. 19-year-old Kareem Mohammed works in a shoe store in Cairo.
Last year there were clients, there was movement, we were able to work. There was a source of income. Now there is no income, there is no season, we do not feel the season, we do not feel the hay.
Some countries, like Indonesia, have even banned the special group prayers for Eid. Others, like Saudi Arabia, are urging people to pray at home. And some, like Iran, are only allowing Eid prayers in open spaces with social distancing. The celebrations and outings that people have grown accustomed to on Eid will not be around this year. As Hajia Rukayat Usman told us from Nigeria.
The normal rituals is after the Salah day, on that day, people go out to visit friends and families. But these days it should be minimized.
That has led many to think of creative ways to bring some kind of normalcy in this abnormal situation. Sehrish Lodhi in Islamabad is preparing to hold video calls with family and friends.
This will be a kind of digital Eid. People will wish each other on phone calls or video calls. I think everyone will get ready and make videos, but won't be able to do much else.
People with children, like Sami Mahmoud of Cairo, are particularly concerned with creating a festive atmosphere at home.
We can take them to the balcony, bring them balloons at home, create for them an atmosphere of joy and happiness of the Eid, so they don't feel like we are in a catastrophe.
In one New Jersey county in the U.S., a Muslim mayor, Hamiduddin, has come up with a unique plan.
For us in Teaneck, I'm going to have, front yard parties, where basically everybody can go out in the front yard, you set up your chairs, you set up your table, and if you want to, people can drive by, and that's the way we're going to all see each other.
One thing is for certain, people will long remember this year's Eid as one of hardship and restrictions. Aisha Tanzeem, VOA News, Islamabad.
And finally, a statue of the late rock and roll legend Little Richard is expected to be installed outside his childhood home in Macon, Georgia. The Little Richard House Resource Center Facebook page announced the tribute this week during a live Zoom meeting. Little Richard died May 9th in Nashville at the age of 87. He was laid to rest Wednesday at his alma mater, Oakwood University in Huntsville, Alabama. The goal is to have the statue erected by December 5th, which would have been Little Richard's 88th birthday. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Bunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thanks so much for listening. Take care and be well.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
And AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at UpfrontAfrica.